Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
I would like to take a moment here and level with you because I think I might have screwed this episode up. I was looking forward to this a lot. I got to speak to Ronnie Spector, the legendary Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes. You know, infamously married to Phil Spector for a period. Anyway, there's a couple of things that leave me unsatisfied about this episode. Number one, recorded it at the CFRU studio, and there were some technical issues, and I can hear them. You know, maybe, I don't know if you will, maybe I shouldn't even brought them up, but I hear them and it bothers me. Secondly, I wasn't quite on my game, I think. I wanted to ask her about working with Joey Ramone, and I didn't even get to it. I feel like I was a little off. That's just me being critical of myself. And then thirdly, this has got to be the last time I do an interview where there's like a cutoff, you know, where they tell me there's a guy, like sometimes you do interviews with people like of Ronnie Spector's status, and there's like usually a dude listening, and he'll be like, all right, you got to go. You got 5 seconds. And you're like, what the hell? This is a conversation type show, but they don't know that. They don't care. Anyway, I can't do this anymore. I can't just talk to people when there's some guy listening and then they cut us off. It's happened a few times on the show and I don't like it. So I'm just being maybe too honest with you. I have a few hangups about this episode. Otherwise, Ronnie seemed lovely and nice and forthcoming. And what a thrill to get to talk to Ronnie Spector. I wish it was a better episode, but it's okay. Maybe, you decide. This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening Boyhood, Slacker, The Grand Seduction, Lucy, Walking the Camino, and more. On Tuesday, September 16th, in the Green Room, Professor Stephen Hennigan launches his new book, Sandino's Nation, Literature and Revolution in Nicaragua. Also on Tuesday, September 16th, Fearing and White perform at the E-Bar. And on Thursday, September 18th, David J. Knight launches his book, Guelph Versifiers of the 19th Century. The Bookshelf is an independently owned culture hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. Visit bookshelf.ca for more information. I was born at the start of the summer of love. I grew up in a world full of change.
It doesn't pay to try. All the smart girls know why. It doesn't mean I didn't try. I just never know why. It's because I'm all alone. Ooh, baby, you're not at home. Still alone. It's so restless I am. Beat my head against the pole. Try to knock some sense down in my
Ronnie Spector is one of the most influential vocalists and performers in all of pop music. Her work with the Ronettes in the 1960s was legendary, altering the face of rock and roll with its style, attitude, and gigantic international hits like Be My Baby, Walking in the Rain, and Baby I Love You, among others. Spector simply casts a long shadow on contemporary culture. influencing filmmakers, fashion designers, hairstylists, and a list of musicians that includes the Beatles, Beach Boys, Bruce Springsteen, the Ramones, and Amy Winehouse, among many others. On September 19th, Spectre heads to Pop Montreal with their acclaimed show Beyond the Beehive, an evening of music and stories about her life. Here now to discuss this further is Ronnie Spector. Hello, Ronnie. How are you?
Hi. How are you, V?
I'm very well. Where in the world are you, Ronnie?
Well, right now, I'm at home in Connecticut.
Nice. How are things in Connecticut?
It's great.
I've never, my uncle lives in Connecticut. I've only been there once. Is there anything that brought you to Connecticut in particular?
Yes, the lovely trees.
Trees, interesting.
My two children.
Okay.
Get out of the city, because I was born and raised in Manhattan, Spanish Harlem.
Right.
So I wanted to get them out of that, and get them to have their own little thing outside, their own little yard, the usual reasons parents move out of the city.
Kind of a suburban life just seemed a little easier.
Right, but still rock and roll.
Now, from what I understand, the Beyond the Beehive show was launched a couple of years ago. Can you tell us more about the show and how it's evolved since you started it?
Well, I started it in like 2001.
Oh.
Out of college. And in just with a girl, piano player, and another girl, guitar player. And I'm telling stories to the audience and about my childhood until I've started making hit records. And after the show, this is a college crowd. They were nuts. So I started thinking, they like this. They like my story. So my manager and I got together and trying to figure out, well, if we do this now, and it snowballed. Really snowballed.
Right.
We said, we'll start this little show here, a little show there. And then I got my band together. I got a couple of girls. You see everything, though, from the time I was born. Literally, I'm 6 months old up there on the pictures. And you'll see videos of me with the Rolling Stones, of course, the Beatles. And everybody. And you see everything of the Ronettes, I don't think it's all their performances, because everything wasn't a film back then, but most of our performances, you see all of that, and backstage shots with, like, Dusty Springfield. I have a couple of pictures with Stevie Wonder and Muhammad Ali.
Oh, wow.
Everything, David Bowie. You have to see it to believe it, as they say.
Now, is anything or anyone off limits with this show?
No. It's for kids. I had an 11-year-old girl come to my show at the winery in New York, and she was in tears. I said, you don't even know my life story. You're only 11. Why are you crying? And she said, because this story, it was so great and reminded me of when I get older and things I want to do when I get older and to how to survive and take care of myself and be independent. I said, my show taught you all of that? it's really a great show for entertainment, to get emotional. I see women out there taking out their Kleenex.
Oh, wow.
I see guys crying, but I also see them laughing, and it's such a great, it's a diverse show. It's so good. Maybe I'm bragging, maybe it's me, maybe it's the audience making me feel this way, because let me tell you, Vish, everywhere I've gone, I've gotten standing ovations, with the show Beyond the Beehive. So it's a great feeling. I come off stage. I don't even have to go to a psychiatrist anymore. All my emotions come out up there. I cry right along with the audience because it's, some parts of it is like, what? And I go, I just love it. I just love crying. I love laughing up there with the crowd. And you see everything from the time I'm born, like I told you, till now. And you see me up there.
Right. Now, we live in an age of very high celebrity exposure. There's a lot of oversharing. Were you hesitant in any way about, sharing these stories about yourself, your entire life, and, talking about the people in your life? Were you hesitant in any way?
Are you kidding? The way these people do today, all they do is show tits and ass, So I'm ahead of the game, I don't understand today's music and a lot of performers. I really don't. Because, to tell you the truth, I'll see somebody that I like 2 years ago, then I never hear of them again.
Yeah.
In the 60s, even groups, little kids today know the name The Beatles.
Right.
Led Zeppelin. they don't, I hear these names and I don't remember them because the artists are gone.
Now, is that...
The singer, the performer, they're no longer around.
But
whether it's hip-hop, rap, you never hear of them again.
Yeah. Is that about cultural consumption or the music industry? Do you have a sense of why that is?
It's just the whole music industry, because everything has changed, as you know. You know, everything is like iPad. I don't even know any of them except my email to send my fans back, you know, messages and stuff. That's all I know.
Right. So
Facebook,
it's
all that stuff, Twitter, forget it.
That's fine. I don't think you're missing much, Ronnie. You're,
I know.
Yeah.
I don't think so either.
Now,
I'm too busy having kids and raising them.
Right. In the show, are you still impersonating people? I heard you were impersonating people.
Really? I used to, but I don't impersonate. I just have a very weird voice, as you can hear probably now. And it's... Oh, I do. I forget. The show is so good. I forget. It's so long. I kind of with Keith Richards.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Yeah, I just, you know, little things like that. But I don't impersonate people. Not even Keith. I'm not even a good speaking like English, you know, over there. Rooney and, you know, all that, you know.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
But I do say a little bit of things in there. I'm not going to give you the whole Shelby.
No, I know. I wasn't asking for a preview. I just wondered if you're doing an like Keith is a very iconic person in his own right. People have done impressions of him. And the idea of you doing a Keith Richards impression just kind of made
me
chuckle.
Especially I'm a girl.
But you know him quite well, right?
Oh, are you kidding? He was on my last of the rock stars I just made a few years ago.
Right.
And he was right there. We did a duet together.
So you're friends?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. We've been friends for 40-some-odd years.
Right.
And he lives 15 minutes from me. They don't live in England. They live here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Right here in Connecticut.
Right. Now, was there anything specific that prompted you to put the show together when you did? You say you started it in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
But was there something that you needed to, you know, you wanted to put a show together? I get the sense that you need to be performing. You're a performer.
Right.
Was there something that prompted you in 2001 to get this kind of show together?
Yeah, it was just seeing like other shows and then saying, I don't want to do just rock, you know, all my shows. And that's when my manager and I came up with, let's do a show about your life, because everybody seems to be interested. And this is since before 2001.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is like when I did the Eddie Money, you know, Take Me Home Tonight video and all that, people were asking. But, you know, I said, nah, I'm not ready yet. You know, I don't think I want to tell my whole life yet, you know.
Right.
But then I felt ready a few years ago. I said, I'm ready. And I felt ready to go out there and tell the good and the bad and the ugly
mm-hmm.
stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because I'm at a certain age. My kids are over 21 now. You know, so I can say things that I didn't want to say before, too.
Right.
But now I can say everything and feel not guilty about any of it.
When
you know, I just feel happy.
Yeah, no, that comes across. When someone looks at your discography, they will see huge gaps. You know, there'll be something from 1961, and then it won't be anything until maybe 1981. I'm maybe exaggerating here, but...
No, you're not, because those years I was married to Phil, and I didn't know I wouldn't have records out. I didn't know I wouldn't be performing. And so there's like 7 years I chunk right there out of my life.
Right.
Of not performing or anything. I didn't even go on the Beatles tour. They used a cousin to replace me, a lookalike.
Right.
And so, you know, and the Beatles were pissed, you know, because they love my voice, so.
Yeah.
They finally got me on Apple Records their way.
That's
even
right.
Even if I had to do a song that I wasn't really happy with.
Right. So these gaps, I mean, we kind of know the extenuating circumstances now, but can you reflect upon those gaps? Like, do you feel like parts of your creative life were robbed from you, were taken from you?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Because first of all, you know, it took me more than 15 years in court to get my royalties for the Ronettes.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, I would work, then I had to stop. I would work, then I had to stop because I had to be in court. And that took so many years. I mean, you just have no idea what I had to go through.
Yeah.
But see, that's the whole point in my show. You can survive, you know, and still strive. You know what I mean? You can still do all of those things. And so many people think when they get to a certain point, well, that's it. I've done it. That's it. You can still go on, and you can still make it, and you can still just stick to it. That's all I can say. And have confidence in yourself.
Well, we know you as this bigger-than-life icon, and...
I know, I hate that word.
I know, but I'm sorry, icon is, it must be a lot to bear.
What does it mean, though, really?
Dictionary-wise. Icon is like someone that just... Well, you're an iconoclast, I guess is what it means. It means that you are someone bigger than life. You are someone that sticks out among your peers.
I like that second one, stand out amongst our peers, because I really do, because I didn't wait for a hit record. I just went out there, boom.
Yeah.
Right after my divorce, boom, I'm out there on stage. I mean, I did oldie but goodie shows until I met up with Springsteen through John Lennon. Then I started doing up-to-date stuff, but I did a lot of oldie but goodie shows, as you call them.
Right.
In the mid-70s. But I did them at Madison Square Garden, Radio City. But I still did oldie but goodie shows. But I loved them.
Yeah.
Lou Anthony and the Imperials. I mean, it was great even then. I love everything that I do if it's on stage and I'm singing. My hits especially.
But I asked you about those gaps in time. And as I say, we know some of the reasons. You also mentioned that you were raising a family. I presume that had something to do with you taking time off from being the performer that you are.
Yeah, I think all women, when they have babies, you know, I had my kids way late, in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, when most girls had already had their kids, you know, from the 60s and stuff. So I waited a while. I mean, I have 3 adopted children,
yeah,
you know, with my ex-husband. But, you know, they were given to me as presents, so I didn't really, you know. And the twins were given to me at, 6 years old, so I didn't know life. Now I have a real life with a real husband, great guy, 2 great kids.
Yeah.
I live in Connecticut, and then I can go out and do my shows. I couldn't do any of that back then. Anything like that. I couldn't go out of the house unless I do a show.
Right, right.
You know, so, I mean, I love my life now. I just have the perfect life. And everybody says, you can't use the word perfect, but mine is pretty close to perfect. 2 great guys, meaning my sons, my husband. We've been married 31 years. I mean, not a lot of people can say all that.
Yeah.
And have gone through what I've gone through in the past.
Yeah, I'm curious. We know you as this, as I say, you're bigger than life. Is there a more quiet or reserved side to Ronnie Spector that we don't know?
Oh, yeah. I hardly talk at all. Hmm. I love to read. I love watching TV. I love staying home and just doodling around in my house. I love going to Bed Bath and Beyond. Stuff like that. And I do a little grocery shopping. Not a lot, because I cannot cook that good. You know, I can make burgers, spaghetti, you know, eggs. But that's about it. I'm not one of those gourmets or anything.
Right, right.
You know, 2-3 times a week we go out to eat, me and the 2 boys and my husband. So I have a really great life. And when we do our shows, I have the band. We were on the same plane. You know, I have 2 girls. And I just have a great life, something I had wanted since the 60s. Now I finally have it.
Well, I want to go back to the 60s and ask you about maybe even before that, actually. What is your first memory of being struck by music in a way that made you think, that's something for me, I should be involved in this somehow?
Well, it didn't quite happen like that. But when I heard Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers on the radio singing, "Why Do Fools Fall in Love?" That was it. It was like a lightning had struck me. You know, it was like, what? What is that I'm hearing? That's the greatest voice I ever heard. So after that, I listened to Frankie Lyman until he was coming out of my ears. My grandmother used to say, Ronnie, you get close, you're going to go deaf if you get any closer to that Philco radio. Things like that, because I loved his voice, and that started it all. Even though I was singing before that with my cousins in the lobby of our apartment in Spanish Harlem and all my uncles and aunts thought I had the greatest voice. But it was after I heard Frankie. I'd come home from school. My sister would be doing her homework. Frankie Lyman was my homework.
Hmm. So you were...
I listened to every lyric. We couldn't afford going to music lessons or piano lessons or vocal lessons back then when I was a little kid. You know, so I learned at home listening to the records.
And
I'd go over and over them again and again, you know, the lyrics.
And was
Frankie was it.
Frankie was it.
The students I loved and the schoolboys, but mainly Frankie Lyman.
And was your family supportive of your interest in music at that point?
They were supportive, but they also knew that it's show business, and any, you know, you may not ever become famous.
Right.
So they knew both sides, you know. And they took me to the Apollo. I have to tell you a quick story, Fish.
Okay.
Fish. Not Fish, but Vish. Yeah, yeah, when I was 11 years old, because I was so, like, the parents were calling from school saying, your daughter, all she talks about is Frankie Lyman, all she does is sing. And it's true. When I come home from school, my sister would do her homework. Frankie Lyman was my homework.
Hmm.
Then the teachers would call my house and say, she's not getting any homework done here, you know. And that's when my parents sort of got down on me. You've got to do a little more homework. We know you love to sing. See, they didn't, like, dismiss me from it. But that's what I was going to tell you. They took me to the Apollo Theater. You know what the Apollo Theater is.
Oh, of course. Of course we do, yeah.
They took me there for amateur night. Me and a bunch of my cousins. And I was so scared. I couldn't believe it. But that was their test. We didn't win, but my cousin Ira was supposed to sing lead for us to be more like Frankie Lyman. We get out there, he couldn't even sing. He opened his mouth and nothing came out. So this is my chance. My parents were out there. I grabbed the mic from him, and I started into Please Say You Want Me by the Schoolboys. And the audience loved me, with my cousins backing me up, ooh and on. And we didn't win, but what a reception I got for the Apollo Theater. That's when my parents turned around and said, well, maybe you've got something, little girl. See?
That's so cool.
So they didn't know I was that good until, you know, the Apollo audience went over on me. They said, that little girl got something.
Right.
She didn't win, but they knew I had something, and my parents no longer disagreed. But I still had to do my homework, please.
I hear you. Everyone should do their homework. I think that's a lesson we're getting here. How did we get from you doing this at the Apollo to the Ronettes?
Oh, we were always together because it's family. One of the Ronettes is my sister, and Nedra's my first cousin. So the three of us, after school, we'd have to meet at my grandmother's house because my parents didn't get off work until like 5:36.
Right.
So that's when we would go to my grandmother's house, and she had this big back room and a long mirror on the wall. And we'd do our own routines, you know, and that's when the twist was coming out and the jerk and all. So we did our own routines, you know, because we looked different.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, my mother is black and Indian, and my father's Irish. And Nedra's mother, who was my mother's sister, her father was Spanish. So we looked different. You know, from the other girl groups?
Yeah, yeah.
We just looked different because we were, you know, interracial, whatever you call that, half-breed. And so we weren't better. We were just different from the other girl groups. And I think that's what drew a lot of attention to the Ronettes.
Right.
And you'll see all of that in my show. I mean, trust me.
I can't wait.
Ronettes, you'll see, you know, everything, you know, the Beatles, you'll see me at the Plaza with them backstage. I mean, everything. So, I mean, I'm holding no bars. I'm giving everything away from the time I think I'm like 6 months old on the first picture you see.
Wow.
So where I am now.
Now, we know that your relationship with Phil Spector took a terrible turn, but we also know that he's credited with inventing something grand, the Wall of Sound. As an artist, what did you make of his techniques in the studio and the records that you made together?
Oh, amazing, amazing. See, I can't ever say anything that was good and just because a couple didn't get along. I had great records. He was a great producer.
Yeah.
You know, but we were so great together as partners in the studio. We worked so well together because I didn't know how to write music or read music. So he would be at the piano. He was a wonderful producer.
Yeah.
I mean, husband, that's another story. He was a great producer. He really was, you know, and with the Wall of Sound, it was the musicians were the Wall of Sound. You know, you had Hal Blaine, you had Earl Palmer, you had Glenn Campbell, you had Harry Nilsson. All these people became stars themselves because they were the wall of sound. You know, Phil was the producer. These were real people. They weren't walls.
Right.
It was wall of sound, hello. I didn't understand it when I first heard that. But these guys were human, and they were great. Hal Blaine, and I had two drummers on a lot of my records, especially like Be My Baby. I had Hal Blaine and Earl Palmer.
Right.
Drummers, and I had Glenn Campbell. I mean, it was so many great, musicians. I can't say it was the wall that did it.
No, it wasn't the wall.
It was Phil and the musicians.
Right.
Together, and with Harry Levine, the engineer. It, you know, they say it takes a village. What, kids? Well, it does with a record, too.
Yeah, I hear you.
One person cannot make all of that, hit and all that. You have to have all the ingredients. It's like when you're preparing a meal.
You have to
have salt and pepper.
Right, right. Is it fair to say that, from your perspective, those are the records you're the most proud of?
Yes. I'm very proud of those records. I mean, it will probably be on my tombstone, Be My Baby or something. I mean, but I don't care because I love them.
Right.
And people ask me, do you ever get tired of... Every time I sing Be My Baby or Walking in the Rain or Baby, it's like I'm just singing them that night for the first time. And I don't know how that happens. I get so nervous. Because my show at the end, I can't give it all away.
Yeah, I hear you.
But at the end, that's when I sing my hits, and it's like, what? And I love them every time. It's like I'm singing them for the first time. And that's the best feeling.
Right.
You know, I don't know how people can get tired of something they made people so happy all over the world, millions of people happy. How could you not like that record? I would always sing it, and I love singing it every time.
As legend has it, Phil hasn't released, or at one point hadn't released, all of the Ronettes material. Have we seen everything or heard everything that you guys made
no,
at this point?
No, you haven't.
Still not, huh?
Are you kidding me? Sometimes my mother would get aggravated because we lived in New York and I would be in California. So Phil would tell my mother, oh, we got to go in the studio, she's got to make another record. So he always had a great excuse. And I did go in there and make more records, but he never put them out. I bet I have about maybe 2-3 albums worth of just me. No Ronettes, just me.
And
that was my solo album. Career.
It's from the 60s.
Never happened.
This is stuff that you recorded in the 60s that just hasn't seen the light of day?
Right, in the 70s too when I was married.
Right.
Every time I get upset and bored, he would take me to the studio and make a record.
I'm sorry, Ronnie, you got to get going in about 30 seconds.
Oh, God.
Oh, boy, we got to get going.
Fish, anything you want to ask, anything.
Well, I guess since we're out of time here, I just want to tell folks that once again, Ronnie Spector is bringing her Beyond the Beehive show to the Rialto Theater on September 19th as part of Pop Montreal. And for more information, people can visit popmontreal.com or ronniespector.com. Ronnie, if there's a song we can go out on right now, what would it be?
Be My Baby, baby.
All right. That sounds fair to me. Ronnie, it was a great pleasure to speak with you, and I hope we speak again sometime.
I hope so, too, Vision. I hope you come to the show.
I'll be there, man.
Okay.
Okay,
great.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Hey, thanks again for checking out Creative Control with Vish Khanna. You can email me about the show at creativecontrol933@gmail.com. That's creative with a K, control with a K, 933@gmail.com. You can also follow our Twitter at Vish Creative, VishKreative. And you can also like our Facebook page. A version of this show airs on CFRU in Guelph every Wednesday at noon Eastern. And you can listen to that online at CFRU.ca, or if you're in the KW region, at 93.3 FM in Guelph. You can also sign up for the weekly mailing list for the podcast and the show at vishkana.com, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I believe that is everything I wanted to tell you. Thank you once again.